From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teig. On today's show, another view of Milwaukee County Transit's future and who should operate the bus service. Later, a new novel explores a centuries-old conspiracy theory about a Bavarian king.
I think he was murdered. So the truth I give you at the end of the book is completely serious. So this could have been the end of King Ludwig.
Milwaukee's Bob Murray talks about dating women across the country and making a movie about it.
Initially, I think when you first met them, they were nervous. So that skewed it a little bit. Maybe when you first met them, they were probably cautious of what they were saying. But after you're with somebody for 8 hours, you kind of forget that the camera's around.
And a short film takes on the theme of creative rejection and yucky things crawling out of the drain. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teig. It's great to have you listening today. We've been getting some perspectives on the future of transit in Milwaukee County in recent days. This summer, the news came out that the for-profit, Texas-based MV Transportation had emerged as the chosen bidder to operate Milwaukee County Transit. If the contract is approved and the process is currently on hold pending appeals, MV would replace the nonprofit Milwaukee Transport Services, which has operated the system for several decades. Jacqueline Jantz is with us in the studio today. She's Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for Milwaukee Transport Services. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I think it would be useful to start if you could perhaps help us understand the relationship between MTS and MCTS. For all intents and purposes, most people think a great deal about MCTS, but maybe they don't even know what MTS is.
Sure. And that's a great thing to clarify. Milwaukee Transport Services is a nonprofit corporation that was formed in 1975 to operate Milwaukee County Transit System for Milwaukee County, obviously. So we are overseen by Milwaukee County. They set fares and structure routes and so forth. They oversee that. And we just are hired to manage the system. And I certainly can see how people are confused about that, you know, are you a Milwaukee County employee and we're not, because we really engage. We're certainly transit advocates. We take furloughs like Milwaukee County did, or make budget cuts like Milwaukee County. We really work very closely with them.
So essentially, you get your marching orders from the county, and then you have to apply those marching orders to how you run the transit system.
Right. And we certainly make suggestions on innovations and changes, but we have to work closely, gathering grants. Certainly, we've talked about the last 10 to 12 years have been huge difficulties. There's been huge difficulties with funding, and we have to work closely together to find funding solutions.
Well, and when it comes to things like fares and routes and such, the county essentially looks to you for the expertise in how to set those?
Sure. And we've used our innovations over the years to actually right now we're implementing new software that's going to help with scheduling to make us even more effective and save the county additional dollars. But we work hand in hand with them to look at the cost. We make recommendations, what's going to save money, what's best for the community. We work with businesses, schools, community groups, the disabled community, one-on-one with individuals, all to find what's going to work best for the community. And we work with Milwaukee County to make those recommendations. But ultimately, they make the decisions.
Well, and so I know we can't talk specifically about how MTS responded to the initial RFP, a request for a proposal, but can you talk in general terms about why you feel MTS's track record is such that you would like to see its relationship to the transit system continue?
Sure. Well, we'd be very proud to be able to continue operating the system as we have for nearly four decades here. We've been leaders in the industry and set best practices standards throughout the time, from freeway flyers to radio systems to maintenance procedures to what we're doing, what we could do in the future. So we're ready to tackle and continue on. And it certainly takes a partner, someone that understands Milwaukee. understands and can work closely with the businesses, as we talked about, businesses. And it's not just finding employees, being able to bring employees to businesses, but to the schools, to help businesses have clientele, et cetera. We've worked so much with Milwaukee County to understand those needs. And when the cuts have come through, we've really been – it's been difficult to make those cuts. So we've done everything we can to make cuts elsewhere. So we really know where we can make cuts where it won't affect service as much as maybe someone else wouldn't know by running the system as long as we have.
It sounds like – not to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're saying that there is no better qualification to run MCTS than having run MCTS.
It is, but there's something more there that people have to understand is that we're not just Milwaukee. We have transit systems across the country that call us up and ask us, how do you get such high fare box revenue? How do you do this? You know, how have you run your dispatch center and so forth? And all that is – there's proof to that. The state of Wisconsin has, for the last 15 years, talked about how efficient we are. They've done audit reports and show that we are a leader – Not just a leader here. We're talking against all of our peers across the country. And those type of statistics about being the most efficient, the most fare box revenue, all those low administration costs, I think that provides the proof that we have the qualifications to keep providing excellent service for Milwaukee.
MTS is a nonprofit entity. Do you think that is a key to the equation in your estimation?
Well, with MTS, our focus is to provide service to the community, and we have a sole mission of connecting people with jobs, school, et cetera. That is our only mission. That's why people don't know who MTS is, because we spend all of our time working on providing transportation, not promoting ourselves.
We heard on this show from the company that emerged as the bidder that was selected and what they see as the issues they would address first. They talked about things like security. They talked about cleanliness on the buses. What do you see as the key issues that MCTS needs to address in both the immediate and long-term future?
Sure. Well, transit is our life. We live and breathe it. And obviously, efficient routes and funding is going to be a key topic, and that's going to continue to be a key topic. We survived the last 2 years ago when the state cut 10% of our funding, which was shocking to us, but we made it through with introducing three new express routes, which have been extremely popular. So being able to look at those innovative ways to create new services. But also in a key is that of how you're going to cut costs. And in 2012, we're $5 million under budget because we provided effective ways in reducing costs, mostly of paratransit costs, with a new Freedom program, and we also did travel training, so forth. But so we were able to cut that $5 million to give back to Milwaukee County so they can see how they want to use those funds. So they can put it back into transit, they can cut fares, they can help pay off their deficit, whatever they want to do. But our goal in the future is to continually be able to find ways to cut and make more efficiencies.
And just to clarify, as you said, it becomes up to the county when the transit system comes in under budget. The money goes back to the county, but the county has to make the decision about whether to roll that money back into transit.
Right. It's an interesting process, and that's why we've worked so well with Milwaukee County. But we'd love to be – when we come under budget, we'd love that money to come back into and be used by transit. So we don't want people to think that we don't know what to do with the money. But, no, it's a process, and the process is we give that money back. But we'd love to be able to put that into service or cut fares, whatever it might be, and we'll just see where we go. I hope that $5 million that we brought back in 2012 can be used towards transit.
And again, I know you can't talk too much in terms of specifics in this process, but MTS filed something called a writ of mandamus in the case. What is the significance of that particular legal filing, and why was that step taken?
Sure. So for when you have a request for proposal, the normal process is that you have an appeal process to make a efficient or to make an adequate appeal, you need to have the information how the process was run so that you can exercise your right to say if it was done fairly or not. But obviously, we need to be able to view information. So the original petition was filed so that we could have the information to make the decision if we would like to exercise our right to make a formal appeal. We would like to know how what information was used to make the judgment so we can make that determination. Now, since that time, we've had to file an appeal, and so that has taken place, but we are still looking for information to make sure that we do it adequately.
How has MTS addressed the uncertainty over the future of the contract with its employees?
Transit has not had it easy for the last 10 to 12 years. We've been facing uncertain budget cuts and so forth, and we're certainly a team. The average employee works at Transit has been there 17 years, so these are people who have gone through a lot with the transit system and know their jobs quite well. Day to day, we're focusing on providing the service to community, and right now, it's actually a very exciting time for our customers and for us because we're able to we are launching three major new technologies that we've been working on for years and work to solidify the funding so we were able to do that. So we have onboard stop announcement system. We're going to have real-time data available for all our customers, and we're having a new electronic fare boxes, which is going to have smart card technology. All that's happening right now, and that's what we're focused on. It's quite incredible to go to transit because when you're there, there's so much going on that we really can't pause right now and think about everything that's happening. We got to focus on providing great service and in launching these new exciting technologies.
And these technologies are rolling out now?
They're rolling out right now. So some people may have seen the onboard annunciators that have been on some of the buses. We're just testing those right now. They're not going to be in full working order, but you're going to start seeing more of those. In October, you'll start seeing new fare boxes on buses. You just use the same way you've been always paying because they're not going to be in full working order until they're all installed. And we're estimating that that will be by the end of this year. But what we said, because these are technology projects, we have to be very studious and make sure that we don't take another step until the first step is accomplished. So we're going to be taking a lot of time to explain to our customers how to stay with us. We'll explain each step of the way, but be watching on the buses. It's going to be quite exciting, especially with the real time coming.
Well, and the real time data is coming when?
So the real time data will be testing that in October too. But we hope by the end of this year that we'll have some of that already up and running. I expect we will, which it will involve a website, text messaging. We'll have phone service. You'll be able to actually see where your bus is every hour of the day. We're ecstatic about it, especially during the snowstorms and so forth when we have later buses that people will be able to find their way. So by within the next 3 months, you're really going to see a lot happening.
Well, Jacqueline James, thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much.
Jacqueline Jantz is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for Milwaukee Transport Services, the organization that currently operates the Milwaukee County Transit System. MTS has appealed the decision to accept the bid of Dallas-based MV Transportation to operate the system in the future. You can hear our other interviews about the future of MCTS at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A break now, and then a literary trip to 19th century Bavaria, complete with royalty, death, and conspiracy theories. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. The Milwaukee Film Festival, which runs into next week, features both films with local ties and also internationally significant titles. One of the latter is a film called Ludwig II, about the 19th century King of Bavaria, who was known as the Mad Monarch or the Fairy Tale King. And since his life is the stuff of legend, it's also the focus of literature, including a new book by author Oliver Putsch, who was in Milwaukee recently to discuss it. The Ludwig Conspiracy is a historical novel that ties together some conspiracy theories about Ludwig's death with real documented history. Putsch, who was from Germany, spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about how the subject matter in this new novel differs from the history he'd written about before.
Well, I tell you, if you just write books about executions and torturings in the 17th century, this makes you some kind of mad. That's what my wife told me. So I needed a break. That's right. I needed a break. And, I was thinking about what could be a good mystery, a historical mystery. And just by accident, I was reading an article in a newspaper, and it was written about this fairy tale King Ludwig and this king building all this castle. And it was written about his mysterious death, because maybe, as you know, the official theory is that the king was declared insane because of building all these castles. He had a lot of debts, 14 million Reichsmark, which is a lot. And they declared him insane, and they arrested him and brought him to this castle back at the Starnberger Lake. And he went out just for a walk with his psychiatrist, Dr. Gooden. And some hours later, the two bodies were found floating in the water. And it is said that the king tried to commit suicide, and he ran into the water, and this psychiatrist followed him to save him. But the king was very, very big and tall, so he strangled and drowned his own psychiatrist and then committed suicide. So this is the official theory. But there are a lot of conspiracy theories in Germany, what really happened. Maybe you can compare it a little bit to John F. Kennedy here. So King Ludwig is not exactly John F. Kennedy, but there are a lot of conspiracy theories about that. And but to know the truth, I think you have to read my book.
Well, not to give too much away about the book, but in it, he was compared to Michael Jackson.
That's right, because what I heard is that in the States you say the Mad King. That's right. You call him the Mad King, because we call him in Germany, we call him the Fairy Tale King. And I think this is much better, because he was not mad. They tried to declare him insane, but I think he was more a borderliner. He was very sensitive. By the way, what is interesting, he was a great Edgar Allan Poe fan. He loved Edgar Allan Poe. He had a social phobia, that's right. He was homosexual, all these things, but he was not mad at all. And I compared him to Michael Jackson. You know, Michael Jackson, he lived in this Peter Pan park with a castle, or I don't know, and slept under an oxygen tent and had this monkey. And I think he died a mysterious death, didn't he?
Yes.
But he was not mad. He was a pop star. He was a little bit weird, strange. And I think King Ludwig would have been a great, great pop star in the 20th century, but he was born in the 19th.
Well, some might consider him just a free thinker.
Yeah, that's right. And what he was a pain in the ass for his ministers. So I don't want to be a minister under King Ludwig, so because he was very choleric, and he slept all day. He just lived in the night. He was not in the capital in Munich. He lived in this castle somewhere in the mountains. So it was very hard to make politics with him. So this is a problem. He was not a pop star. The problem was he was a king, and a king has to rule.
Given that there are so many conspiracy theories about his death, how did you – I mean, is your book based on one of those theories, or did you create your own? Or did you go into this thinking that at first you would have to choose between theories, or did that lead you to create your own perhaps?
So let me say, when I started my research, I was thinking, okay, I write now some fictional stuff, but I think the official theory is the right one. But after doing all these researches, now I'm at the point that I say something stinks. This is not the truth. I don't know exactly what happened, but I think he was murdered. So the truth I give you at the end of the book is completely serious. So this could have been the end of King Ludwig. The only thing which is maybe a little bit an invention is I created a villain, a bad guy who is at the end the murderer of him. And I don't know this person, but you need this if you write a fictional novel, you always need a strong villain. So this is my invention. But everything else I think could be the truth.
Including the secret society, the cowled men?
For sure, for sure. We call them the Google Männer, because Google is the word for hood, what they have. They are a secret organization. They still exist in Bavaria, and they are quite influential there. So there are, it's said that there are some powerful men among them, maybe politicians. And I tried to get in contact with them. It's very hard. But they still try to prove that the king was not a murderer and didn't commit suicide, but that he was murdered up to now. And this is the reason why my book is, on the one hand, is an encoded diary from the 19th century, but on the other hand, is a contemporary thriller, because I found out that there are so many interesting things in our days to write about Ludwig II. I couldn't write just a book in the 19th century, so it's also a thriller.
Can you give us an idea of how King Ludwig of then is viewed now? And did you have to worry at all about presenting him in a way that may be too unfavorable for some people?
I was a little bit afraid then when I did my readings in Bavaria that there were some cult men waiting for me and said, don't go into this reading, stay outside, and so on. So they didn't show up. But at some readings, there were old people, and they the most problem they have is to say that King Ludwig was homosexual, which he definitely was. And I mean, this is no problem. We've got now a foreign minister in Germany who's homosexual. Our mayor in Berlin is homosexual. No problem at all. And I can't understand why they make such a problem out of this. So that's it. But all the other things, I mean, I write a book about the king is murdered, so I'm on their side. I'm on the side of this cult man, but not with these homosexual things.
Okay. Well, did you have anything to worry about from the modern monarchy?
This is the Wittelsbacher dynasty. So this is still the dynasty from King Ludwig II. They still exist, and they are quite powerful in Bavaria, as I know, because I worked long as a television journalist. And if you work as a journalist in Bavaria, it said, don't blame the Pope and don't blame the Wittelsbacher. These are the two things. Never blame them. So they are quite powerful, and they ignored me. They ignored me. I don't know. I think they read the book. They read the book, but they ignored me because they've got this huge archive, and it is said that in this archive you could find information about what really happened, but they do not allow any person to get into this archive. Not any writers, but also historical researchers. They are not allowed to get into this archive.
I find it interesting that you brought up the modern repository of books that no one's allowed to read from the family, the monarchy, where that contrasts interestingly with the book, which is one of the characters is an antiquarian bookseller, where you couldn't even get people to read it if you paid them. I mean, so it's interesting that a lot of this is so focused on old literature that either you can't read or people don't want to read.
That's right, yeah. But if you read my books just by accident, books are always in the center of my novels. I don't know why, because maybe it's just I love books and I love old bookshops. As I was a kid, I always went in these old bookshops just to smell it, just to smell these old books like this old books, this bookseller Stephen Lucas does. And maybe this is the reason also in The Hangman's Daughter series, there's one character, this is Simon, who's a doctor there, and he loves books as well. So, and also in other books I wrote, it's always with old books, yeah.
I was pleased to see that in the story, Milwaukee is just a tiny little part of the story.
Yeah, that's right. that's right. And I think the reason was that I've been here, as you can remember, 2 years before. And this was done the time when I found out that you've got a lot of German immigrants here and so on. And then I was writing and I needed a newspaper. And then I needed an American newspaper, which has a lot of German points of interest in it. And I said, I was remembering, hey, I've been to Milwaukee for this interview. Milwaukee, this is the German town in the U.S. So I've chosen Milwaukee, and it's fine. I forgot it. But this was the reason for that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm sure everyone here will appreciate that.
Okay. I love Milwaukee. It's true.
All right. How did you approach the fact that it's a modern novel and you have two people who are basically trying to find out what happened 125 years in the past, and through books or through mainly one book in particular without, again, giving too much away. So, again, this idea that literature opens the door to the past, is that – would you classify that as a theme or is that just accidental?
In my book, it's an encoded diary, and step by step, they found out that this diary was written by a witness of King Ludwig's death, and they found out what really happened. So for me, it was interesting when I was doing my research, I found this kind of diary. I was talking to an art professor, very old one, 91 years old, and he told me that he bought a diary from the personal doctor of King Ludwig. It's called Max Schleiß von Löwenfeld. And in this diary, everything is written. So this personal doctor was the witness of King Ludwig's death. Everything is written in it. And he told me he's got the diary now, but he was threatened by strangers. And so dangerous to have this diary so that he decided to hide it somewhere. And I asked him, where did you hide it? And he told me, it's in a safe in the United States. That's true. So maybe, maybe the secret of King Ludwig is somewhere here in Milwaukee or in some other city in the United States. And I couldn't find out if it was the truth or not. But for me, this was this point where you say, this is the story. I mean, this is great. There is an encoded diary, and he showed me some pictures of this diary. And the diary I use in my book, the cover is the same than this diary the professor told me about. So maybe there is a real one.
All right. Well, going through the book, it's quite the page turner. So if I may just say so.
Thank you.
It also, you're welcome. It reads like, and I hope you don't find this kind of dismissive and insulting, but it could be a movie. I mean, I can easily see that I can picture it in my mind. Is that something that you have in mind, or you also were a television producer? I don't know.
That's right. I mean, I think because I work for television, when I write, I always write in pictures. I see in front of my eyes, and it's like a movie when I write. So it's the same with the Hangman's Daughter series, and actually we are now in contact with some people who will do a movie out of the Hangman's Daughter series. So maybe the Ludwig conspiracy will be the next. So we see. And the other thing is that you say a movie. So the main character, this bookseller, not by accident, his name is Stephen Lucas, which is a mixture, I have to say, sorry, for Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
Another secret revealed. Yes. Well, Oliver, thank you very much for coming on. Good luck with your next piece of work. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oliver Putsch is the author of the new novel, The Ludwig Conspiracy, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. He was in Milwaukee earlier this month for readings at Boswell Book Company and Mystery One, and he spoke with Dan Harmon then. A Milwaukee man travels around the country, setting up dates with women through online dating services, all the while making a movie about it. We'll learn how he fared when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Bob Murray was not planning to become a filmmaker, but a few years ago, the Milwaukee area banker took stock of the state of his dating life and decided that his only real choice was to go on a nationwide quest to find love and make a movie in the process. The result is Date America, a movie that makes its film festival premiere at the Milwaukee Film Festival this week. It chronicles Murray's trip across the country and his efforts to connect with potential mates he met through online dating services. Murray joined us in the studio recently to give us the backstory of his trip from Milwaukee to Los Angeles and the 8 dates he went on. Bob Murray, did you have any experience at all making movies before you made this one?
Zero. I mean, when I was a kid, we had a camcorder and I'd make videos from the age of like 6 until 12. But after that, I didn't make anything. But I always had fun doing it back then, and I was always interested in stories. My favorite things to watch are documentaries, and it's going to make me sound old, but I love 60 Minutes and CBS Sunday Morning. Those are shows that I've always loved. I loved 60 Minutes when I was 10 years old. So I love stories, and I figured that this was something that was worth telling. And I wanted to show couple things. I want to show online dating. Number two, I want to prove to everyone just because you don't have expertise in doing something, there's always a way to figure out and to do it. And now I've done a movie and it's going to be at the Milwaukee Film Festival.
Well, and the way you figured out to do it was you hired a crew, right?
Well, first thing is you talk to whoever you can and you talk to dozens of people. And I eventually ended up putting an ad on Craigslist, finding several people that are willing to do it, but chose a group of guys in Chicago which were really young. I mean, 20 years old, but had I thought they had a lot of talent and they had a lot of energy. And I wanted to have that energy with me as well.
Well, and all the time you're learning how to make a movie, you're also learning something about dating, presumably. Let's again turn the clock back. What was dating for you before you set out to make this film?
Well, I had been in a couple long-term relationships, but I was single for a couple of years before I did the trip. But dating for me at that point, when you're 34 years old in Milwaukee, you already have your set defined friends. You already know your work friends. So you're not exactly meeting new people because at 33, 34 years old, girls aren't looking to pick you up at a bar. They don't want to find a guy at a bar. It's not a place they want to meet their future lover. So for me, I tried online dating a little bit in Milwaukee. It wasn't that successful. I would meet random people here or there, but nothing was sticking and nothing was I mean, the referrals to your friends, how many referrals can you get after you've known people for 10 years? They know – you know everybody they know, so you're not meeting new people that way. So it was just kind of getting stale and stagnant.
So you set out to do this. 3 weeks, 8 dates, correct?
I wanted to do 9. So my idea was I'm going to – this is my thought process. That I'm going to stop in 9 cities and I'm going to go on 9 dates. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go online. I'm going to set up 9 dates. And once all 9 are set up, I'm going to hit the go button. Boom. I'm just going to drive from city to city and go on these dates. What I didn't expect was, at least I guess this is a good sign for these women, is they didn't want to date me. They wouldn't want to agree to date 3 weeks in advance. They said, Bob, well, how do I know I'm going to be single 3 weeks in advance? So I had half the dates set up by the time I left Milwaukee. Half of them canceled by the time I got to my first city. So the 3 weeks really turned into a race to try to find women to date me in every city. And sometimes I didn't have a date the day before I hit there. So it was pretty stressful trying to find the women. But I emailed a lot of people. I mean, every city I'd probably look at 400 to 500 profiles. I'd email 50 to 80 women. And of those 50 to 80 women, maybe 10 to 20 were right back. And only one or two would say, I agree to go on a date with you and I agree to get filmed.
Hello. It's nice to meet you in person.
Good. How are you?
Thank you. My name is Marie. I'm 27 years old and I am an administrative assistant at a CPA firm. When we met online, well, I didn't really think the documentary was real. And I got to talking with him and he was really nice and really down to earth and I really dug his personality. I would say overall, online dating is a good tool for meeting new people.
You had to not only convince women that they wanted to go out with you, but they wanted to go out with you and have the experience filmed.
Yeah, which I thought was really cool for them to agree to do that. Now, I thought there'd be two schools of people that would want to date me. I thought there'd be the one school that was really adventurous in saying, this sounds unique and I want to be a part of something that I think sounds cool. And I thought there would be a second camp of women that would say, I just want to be on film. I didn't find the camp of the women that just wanted to be on film. I was kind of hoping I would find one or two women in that camp. I did have a couple of women ask for money, which we didn't pay anybody. We didn't agree to pay anyone and didn't have them on. But I ended up finding women that just thought the idea was interesting and wanted to be part of something that they thought was an original idea.
Well, and in a way, that's sort of the spirit that you were going into this with too. I mean, that would seem like you're meeting the right group of women who were into it for the adventure.
Right. I was pleasantly surprised with how genuine and down-to-earth and cool the girls are that I met. Because when you talk to guys that go online dating, everybody complains. Like, oh, the dates are awful. The guys complain all the time. Oh, the women I met, she wasn't any fun. Or the biggest complaint is she weighed more than her photographs. Like that's not a huge thing, no pun intended. But the women, I'd talk to the women and they would have horror stories. Like, oh, I met this guy and he was 20 years older. Or I met him and we went on a few dates and found out that he has a family. And the guys are the ones that lie all the time. The women were fairly normal people. And that was nice to see.
I wonder about the dates themselves. I mean, did you worry that just the fact that you were making a movie while you went out with these women might skew the data, if you will, that the date would have played out differently if not for the camera crew that was along?
Well, every date that I went on, it has to skew it a little bit. But the dates were long. I mean, the shortest date was 4 hours. The longest date was 16 or 18 hours. I mean, these were long dates. The average date was probably 8 hours long. So initially, I think when you first met them, they were nervous. So that skewed it a little bit. Maybe when you first met them, they were probably cautious of what they were saying. But after you're with somebody for 8 hours, you kind of forget that the camera's around. And throughout the process, too, they would get to know throughout 8 hours the camera crew and the assistants. So I introduced everybody in the crew. So after a while, it felt like they were hanging out with friends. And that's the point where you want to get so you can start having a real conversation with them. Also, every one of the girls, I spent a little bit of time off camera with them. Especially after we're done shooting, just to talk to them and get to know them to see if things were different. There was only one girl that I felt I thought she was nervous being on camera, and we actually shut the cameras off for a little bit to see if I could get her to open up a little more. She never did. But off camera, on camera, I think they may have been nervous in the beginning, but I think it shows them as to what they're really like.
How about you? Were you nervous when this whole thing started?
Nah, the first one maybe it was, but I don't get that nervous. I mean, my friends that you'll see in the movie, I'm self-deprecating quite a bit. So it doesn't matter to me I'm not afraid of saying something dumb or afraid of saying something that people might find embarrassing because I just don't get embarrassed that often anymore. And there's plenty of stuff in the movie that I cringe at when I see it. But I had the editor leave it in because it's real, it's true, it's kind of about me, and that's what I wanted to show the real me. I didn't want to show this dramatized, great version of myself.
This sounds like it puts some reality back into the idea of reality television or reality movies in this case.
Yeah, I mean, it's a reality concept, and honestly, this is a really egotistical thing and vain thing to do. I mean, you're going out there across America and you're saying, look at me, I'm so cool, I'm going to film myself, and you're going to want to date me to be in this. It's an extremely vain concept. And so it's a reality concept, but it shows more like a documentary.
Well, and at the same time, it seems like a really amazing opportunity. I mean, you know, it's been a while since I have been in the dating pool, but seriously, who hasn't gone out on a first date and wished they could review the footage later?
Well, that's one thing. Is number one, you review the footage and watching 8 hours yourself on a date, you kind of realize you're pretty boring for a lot of it. So you can condense it down to make it something that's more interesting.
Do you feel you got better? I mean, is it like watching game film? Did you get better as the experience went?
No, I love going on first dates. Which is crazy. I mean, I love meeting new people. I think meeting somebody for the first time or second time is great. The third or fourth time I don't care for as much, or they probably don't care to meet me the third or fourth time as much. But I love first dates. I love meeting new people. So that's really is what I enjoy. But the one thing is there is somebody that I don't want to blow everything, but there was a girl that I really fell for in the movie. And the crew agreed. They're like, there was a favorite girl the whole trip. So I sent all the footage to my editor. I said, here's how I saw the story happen. And I gave him an outline. Is this what I think happened? Well, he's going through it, and he watches this date with a girl that everybody says, this is the girl that is is the best. And he calls me and said, Bob, I don't see it. He goes, I don't know why you like this girl. And I said, well, let's keep looking at it. Cause I mean, the crew thought she was the best too. And after watching it, you're like, yeah, I don't know why of all the 8 girls, she's not saying that she's the least likable by any means, since she's a very nice girl, but she's not the most likable at all. And I think watching the movie, people are kind of like, I can't believe this is the girl that you like, but it was the girl that I liked.
Well, and I wonder if that doesn't just tell you something about chemistry, that there's something you just can't see or quantify about it.
Well, there is. And I think attractiveness leads a lot into it, too, and, you know, the physical side of it. But there's obviously there's more about liking somebody versus just the verbal part of it, the visual, all the other cues add into it. And it didn't show on film is very well, I'll tell you that much. But when we were there in person, we all kind of got sucked in a little bit.
Did it change how you have approached dates since then?
The beforehand, afterwards, having the story, and this is one thing I realize about, you know, if you want to be a great, if you want to be good at dating, and if you want, especially being a guy, if you want women to like you, be an interesting person. Women would much rather end up with a person that's extremely interesting than somebody that's extremely good looking. So I'm lucky that this helped me become more interesting because it was something to talk about. And I met a lot of women through this process because they were just kind of intrigued about the about what I did. And that helped out. It helped out a lot. I mean, had I known how good of a plan this was, I would have done this years ago because I probably would have been married years ago had I did this when I was 24 or 25.
Well, Bob Marie, I'm so glad that you you brought us the story. Thanks so much for sharing it, and best of luck.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Bob Marie is the director and the star of Date America, a documentary that follows his cross-country online dating quest. The film screens this Wednesday and Sunday at the Milwaukee Film Festival. You can find more information about it from a link at wuwm.com/likeeffect. The movie is paired with a short film by Milwaukee and Kate Balsley. We'll learn about that movie when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we met filmmaker Bob Murray, who traveled around the country and, at the risk of personal rejection, filmed his experiences on 8 first dates with women he'd met through online dating services. Kate Balsley's short film, which screens along with Murray's movie at the Milwaukee Film Festival, draws upon personal experiences on the topic of creative rejection. Her film is called The Cucarantula. When a spider crawls out of the sink one night during a business date, things go from bad to worse to better. The film is peppered with animation and quirky characters, and Balsley stopped by the Lake Effect studio recently to speak with Nathan Royster and share the story of the film.
There's not a biographical element to this film, and so I thought that to make the character a writer, it was kind of like maybe a thinly disguised veil for myself being a filmmaker.
And so how did the idea come about?
Well, there were several things. For one thing, when I was a graduate student, I lived down in Carbondale, Illinois, and I lived above a Thai restaurant. And no matter how clean I kept my apartment, in the summers we were always getting cockroaches. So things were always coming out of my bathroom drains. And it was pretty icky. It was pretty icky. And one afternoon I'm in the bathroom and I'm washing my hands and I notice that there's this gigantic cockroach had crawled out of the drain and it's waggling its antennas at me menacingly. Of course, I freak out and I can't handle cockroaches, but my roommate could and she was just able to smash them with the nearest library book. But I think what really inspired the film was one night I was out with somebody and I asked him, what do you think of my latest piece, my latest film? And he says, do you want me to give you an honest response? And I said, of course. You know, I value honesty. I value creative criticism or rather constructive criticism. He says, okay, to be perfectly honest, I'm glad you didn't show anybody because you really embarrassed yourself. I took it, you know, very personally. And, I was very, very upset by the remark. And since he was a friend, I valued his input. And I went home and I deleted the project off of my computer. And so, you know, that the copy no longer existed. Looking back on the experience, I really, really wish that I hadn't. I really wish I hadn't based my evaluation of this project based on one person's opinion. We tend to ignore all of the positive comments on our work and focus on the one or two negative, opinions and put all of our energy on that. And so so those two things, the creatures crawling out of my drains and, you know, the very, very bad comments I got on one of my earlier pieces inspired the film.
And I think that's really parallels the short film too, because you have the cucarantula and it doesn't really ever get seen by the main character Paige.
Yeah.
As where like all the harshness of her dinner date Clive.
Yeah.
He's very outspoken and is actually pushing his work on her.
Right. Yeah. The characters are cardboard cutouts. You know, there's really not too much complexity in the characters. I wanted to make something that was very obvious. And so Clive, so brilliantly portrayed by my good friend Zach McLean, you know, he just over the top, but not so over the top. And, you know, he's just kind of he's enveloping all of these negative characteristics that we associate with, you know, the pompous artist, arrogance and pride and not being able to look outside of his own, you know, his own work. You know, there's people who, you know, he obviously he's getting a kick out of putting her down in order to build himself up. And, you know, in the dinner scene especially, he's pretty blind to the fact that he's, you know, really kind of ripping her heart out.
Well, and I love on the back because he hands her the book, his 10 stories, and it says like pedantic masterpiece on the back.
Quotes, truly quotidian.
Well, my words simply come out of me as if carried by a zephyr.
I'm so glad you noticed that. Yeah, that was just a tiny, tiny little touch that I'm really proud of. You know, he's proud of himself because he topped J.D. Salinger by writing 10 stories, not 9. Yeah, no, the Cucarantula, it's you know, it's a little difficult to pronounce, but just think combination of cucaracha and tarantula.
Yeah.
Because those things crawling out of my drain in Carbondale were pretty big. I don't think they were your average cockroaches.
I like the Cucarantula itself. I'm just wondering, did you do all the animation for that? Because it seems to be a recurring theme in some of your work is animation and illustration.
I actually enlisted the help of a student of mine, Brooke Duckert, who I saw her piece Cat Waco at the Student Film Festival, and I was just blown away by it. The attention to detail that she put into the characters, the movement, even just the mise-en-scène of the set itself. And so I recruited her, and I showed her the script, and I said, listen, there's a lot of animation. You're going to, you know, because essentially she was a student at the time. And I said, you're going to be responsible for animating an eight-legged creature, and you're going to be responsible for giving this eight-legged creature a personality. You know, this is no small feat. And she just jumped at the chance. I mean, she just said, yes. Brooke just jumped at the chance, and she said, I want to do this. And I said, you really have to think about it because you are a student. Your own work comes first. You know, this is going to be a big commitment on your part. And she says, no, let me do this. Let me do this. And so for the next few months, she designed the creature. She assembled the creature. She completely, you know, imbued it with this personality. You know, we were, the cast and crew and I, when we were watching the clips of animation that she had done, just the tests, you know, we were just astounded. You know, she had so much attention to detail. She was watching how spiders move, you know, how they act. But at the same time, she was also creating this fictitious character. Because we didn't want it to be, you know, 100% realistic spider, because that would just be a little too creepy. And it would just kind of remove you from the fantasy element of the piece. You know, it's a creative animal. It's a Cucarantula. And yeah, no, she was also responsible for designing the 2D animation sequences. Like, in between the space of the live-action scenes, you see, you know, these kind of vignettes of exterior shots of Clive driving in his car and, yeah, you know, exterior locations of the apartments. If we had gone out and shot real locations, I think the project would have lost its magic. It's such a far-out scenario anyway, so we needed to create this fantastic realm of neither quite here nor there, not quite real, not quite fantasy, this in-between liminal space. Her work just really tied the piece together.
So did you give her complete creative control over what the Cucarantula looked like? And was that all her? Did you give her any direction at all?
I basically said, this is kind of what I'm looking for. I said, you know, this is, you know, and the script describes it as a frightful little thing, as if like a seventh grade science class had, you know, tried to clone a cucarantula and went, or tried to clone a tarantula and went terribly, horribly wrong. So I kind of just gave her like a blueprint and I said, this is what I have in mind. And she just took it and she built on it. This is actually my first time directing a short narrative film. Usually I'm an experimental filmmaker, and I would have total control over my project. I'd be in charge of the images, the sound, the editing. But this time I was recruiting, you know, the talents of a crew and, you know, the talents of an animator. And one thing that I learned about being a director is sometimes you just have to relinquish control and put your faith in the talents of your people, your crew. And if you do that, you know, really marvelous things can happen. And like, for instance, my cinematographer, Quinn Hester, I just stood back and let him work. And he was easy to work with. He was, you know, very experienced. He, you know, you can't put the camera there because of this and this. And no, you can't put the camera there because of this and this. And he knew exactly what he was doing. He was very efficient. And, you know, with Brooke, I just said, yeah, this is what I'm looking for. And she came up with her own very creative ideas. So
a short film is essentially, it seems like as much work goes into it as a normal length film. And when we first were getting in contact to do this interview, you had said, and even earlier this morning, that there's not much emphasis or media put on short films. Like, I mean, even being able to go see them is very difficult unless it's before a Pixar film.
Yeah. No, I don't blame the Milwaukee Film Festival at all for that. You know, they have limited space, I understand. You know, they're very, very good at they're very, very good at publicity and marketing. But the short films usually just have like one line in the catalog, director, name, and proceeding. And yeah, no, we took a year and a half to make this piece. You know, it's only about 13 minutes long. And so, yeah, with short films, I mean, you can't just walk into a multiplex and pay $10, $15 on a short film. You know, usually you see them in collections, and they're not really all that marketable unless they're in some kind of traveling, touring showcase. And here in Milwaukee, you know, last time I saw a short film was either at the Union Theater or at the Time Cinema. And, yeah, they just don't tend to get the publicity features do. They're just not as marketable. You know, you're not going to spend the money on a short film that you would a feature.
Your film, but The Cucarantula, it's kind of rolled in with a bunch of other films. And I assume you don't have any control over that, do you? Or do you get a pick, sort of?
No, I got the email from the festival coordinators, and they said, your film is going to be preceding Bob Murray's Date America. And initially, I was a little disappointed that it wasn't part of the Cream City Showcase, the Milwaukee show, because that's this really fabulous collection of some of the best short films that are being made by Milwaukee filmmakers. And everybody in town comes out for that. The Oriental Theater is packed. It's a great way to share your work with the community. And so I was a little bummed. But then I did some research on Bob Murray's film. And it seemed like it was a great match. And Bob Murray, he's getting a lot of publicity for Date America. It sounds like there's a really, really great documentary on Bob's quest to find a relationship, how he takes it upon himself to travel throughout the United States looking for a relationship. And my film is kind of like this date gone horribly, ridiculously wrong. There's insulting and cucarantulas and, you know, I'm not going to reveal what happens with the cucarantula. You have to go out and try to see the film. So it looked to me, I'm like, wow, this actually looks like a pretty great pairing of my piece and Bob's piece. But yeah, so I think it's going to be an interesting combination. And I think it's going to be really great to see the two of them together.
Well, Kate Bosley, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you. This is really fun.
Milwaukee filmmaker Kate Bosley's short film is called The Cucarantula. It'll screen Wednesday and Sunday at the Milwaukee Film Festival alongside Date America, which we heard about earlier on the show. Bosley spoke with Nathan Royster. That's Monday's show. Tomorrow, as Obamacare is scheduled to go into effect, we'll speak with a Madison doctor about his effort to bring direct primary care to the masses. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.